Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly libertarian news and commentary podcast brought to you by the magazine whose staffers will never, ever serenade you, at least not in public, with tunes from the musical Oklahoma. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and a triumphantly returned from Rehoboth, if that's a real beach, Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, freedom fighters.
Howdy.
Hello, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to hear a little bit about how the gang contracted monkeypox in Vegas. But first,
shouldn't have made that bet. Big mistake.
Astute consumers of Reason product may have noticed over the years that we have a healthcare problem in this country. The government continues to expand steadily toward Medicare for all. All of you healthcare.gov quote-unquote customers should really think hard about trying something new called CrowdHealth. CrowdHealth is not insurance. It's an alternative way to pay for your healthcare. No surprise bills, no doctor networks, no government or insurance company standing between you and your doctor. Check them out at joincrowdhealth.com. Enter the promo code REASON and get a plan starting at $99 a month for the first 3 months. Visit joincrowdhealth.com today. It's not easy to say fast. You'll be glad you did. Okay. So here's my question. What if they threw a we're all going to wear masks again party and no one came? That's what I'm thinking right now when trying to sort of square the lived-in reality, as I've seen cavorting about New York City over the past several days, trying to square that with the following headlines that we've seen over the weekend. COVID case increase prompts the return of masks, says NBC News. Seattle Times, CDC says COVID level high in King County recommends masks. Los Angeles County mask mandate supported by President Biden COVID expert, reports Deadline. Whatever happened to you, Nikki Finke? Similar stories in Hawaii, Boston, San Diego, Montgomery County, Maryland, and on and on. We will talk about the serious policy debate implications of all that stuff in a half second. But I just got to tell you, anecdotally, walking around here, the only place where anyone is wearing a mask anywhere is very half-heartedly in the subway. It seems pretty impossible to imagine this stuff catching fire again. You three people were out canoodling in Las Vegas, I saw, according to the internet, flying around the country and so forth. Does any part of the America that you have recently visited give you the impression that Americans are ready to embrace new restrictions? Catherine?
I was not in Las Vegas, at least in part because
I
was
in Vegas.
Because I was on vacation, but I was not in Las Vegas, at least in part because I was like, let's give it another year on the COVID, because if there is a cluster of risk-taking anti-masker monkeypox carrying people, you know, they're there. And so I was like, let me give it a little space. And this is also basically my COVID strategy at this point, is like, am I going to put myself face first into where I think there is likely to be the greatest disease density? No. Am I going to take any other precautions? Also no. I spent the week in Rehoboth, as you noted, and it was, you know, it's like an outdoors place, right? It was the beach, it was the boardwalk, all the restaurants were patios. I really didn't see a mask for the entire week, and I think that that is probably the future we're headed for. I will say I got home, and I have to take my kids to the dentist today, and I filled out a, no joke, like 27-question form for each child, which was just me saying, no, they don't have COVID, over and over and over. And so I do think we are now settling into permanent COVID security theater, and that the return of masks in some places will be a part of that. But it will just be theater, because nobody wears their masks right, and they don't wear the right masks. It is true, I think, though it is hard to tell at this point, that like a correctly fitted N95, blah, 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 like in a clinical setting, that works. Those do work. They do reduce transmission. I have not seen in the wild a correctly fitted N95, maybe ever, but certainly not in 2020.
How do you know?
Because it's...
How do you know if it's correctly fitted?
If I can see into the side of the mask, it's not on right. That's all.
Speaking of security theater,
I went through an ordinary TSA line for the first time in a long time this weekend. Normally, I go through TSA PreCheck.
Fancy.
But for various reasons, I didn't this weekend.
What were those reasons? Are you on a no-fly list, or what are you hiding?
It's because I have monkeypox. And
we shouldn't joke about it. It's gonna,
we should not.
Age
they
want
to give it to as
it's
many
already
people
aged
as possible.
Badly,
yeah.
And I regret my entire life up to this point. But it was notable in the Las Vegas airport. Almost no one was wearing masks except for the TSA agents, all of whom were wearing cloth masks below their nose, with like their nostrils exposed, and just constantly, so you couldn't hear them because the mask was just like, play through there, go through the line. And then people would be like, what? And so they just take the mask off and talk to you and then put it back. It's just, it's security theater for security theater.
Nick, what did you see in the real America that is Las Vegas in terms of mask wearing?
I was double masking over my eyes for much of
for your safety.
And still the disease got through.
So I didn't see a lot, but I feel kind
of
good.
What is like the pasty equivalent of a mask? That's the real, you know, just a little something to preserve your modesty.
They don't have a word for it yet, but there were a lot of them on the Vegas Strip.
I mean, I was actually kind of surprised in Vegas. There was a smattering of masks throughout the casino and even at Freedom Fest in the audience and stuff like that. You know, I mean, it would be certainly under 10%. It might be closer to 5%. Peter could come in with as unscientific a guess, but you know, some people were there wearing masks, but yeah, generally it.
Peter,
it's
you've talked in the past about kind of masks as a good symbolic look at how public messaging and public health policy has failed and been silly during COVID. Looking now at the return of mask season, or at least a half-hearted attempt at the return of mask season, how do you look at that now? How does that play out now in, you know, year two, at the 2.5 year mark of us marking time through this?
I think what we're seeing is that the people who are still deeply anxious about COVID are people who want to see some visible sign that everybody else is anxious and trying to do something too. And the most obvious way to show that is to wear a mask or to require people to wear masks. And so when you see public health bureaucrats or, you know, public health experts or public health journalists sort of say, we're still in a pandemic and we have to do something, that something is almost always, well, we need to either expect or require people to wear masks. And the reason is that that's the thing you can see. It makes it clear that you care, and it's a sign that you care. And I wore a mask pretty consistently, even in cases where it was, at this point, couldn't possibly have been valuable for about the first year or so, from March 2020 through about March or April of 2021. Even, you know, walking my dog more or less alone at night, as my neighbors did. But I think if you look at the research, if you look at the studies that actually attempt to measure the effect of mask mandates by looking at things that happen in the real world, not by comparing what happened in the real world to an epidemiological model, but by actually using real-world measurement, which is admittedly imperfect. We can't run a perfectly controlled experiment. But if you look at those studies, you see very, very little evidence that mask mandates actually do much to reduce spread. Maybe they do just a little bit, but even there, that's the evidence for that is pretty dicey. And again, that doesn't, as Catherine said, that doesn't mean that masking doesn't or can't work. Obviously, medical masks in a medical setting, right? Properly used N95s. Actually, I mean, and even I will say, if you are concerned yourself, there's been a number of articles and studies about one-way masking. And if you yourself are very worried about this, you don't need to call for everybody else to be wearing a mask. Wear an N95 yourself when you are out, because one-way N95 masking, if it is properly fitted, actually does work pretty well. And so people can take care of themselves. People can make these decisions on their own. You know, and I think one thing that, you know, those of us who are like, I'm done wearing masks should do is say, look, it's totally okay to wear a mask. If that's a choice you want to make, that's great. We support it. What we don't want is to see that enshrined in a policy that has proven over and over again across the world to not be very effective at preventing transmission.
Which leads us to a discussion of Barbara Ferrer, who is the L.A. County Director of Public Health, who, you know, is kind of one of the people who's been pushing extreme and generally useless and over-the-top responses to COVID in L.A. and is at it again. I agree with Peter. I'm disturbed by people who yell at people who random people wearing masks, especially, you know, and at Freedom Fest, I felt bad for the people wearing masks because there was a ton of anti-mask joking, et cetera, at people's expense. And the ones who were tended to seem be older or have conditions that they were concerned about. And I'm kind of happy to see them out and about. But Barbara Ferrer and the public health officials who are insisting on masking long after the fact that, or, you know, long after the idea that it is really going to be useful, really need to come under more scrutiny.
Josh Barrow, who I think that we should just pronounce his name Barrow from now on. Just if you have the double R, just go for it.
I don't like the Joshua with an Italian last
name. You don't
like
a mongrelization of Americans, Nick? What's...
I like mongrelization, but I think, you know, and this might just be the Italian-American and Irish-American, it should be like Liam or Seamus or Seen, something like that.
I'm sorry,
I think his name is Josh, and that's okay.
Version of Ian.
I don't feel like we need to have an opinion on what his,
come on, his dad
what
is
Josh
Robert,
Barrow's name
okay?
should
Although,
have
come
been.
Come on, like, get,
I recently
become
learned
American
about the
already.
Concept of Josh fights. Is that that's a thing
this
that
is a,
happened?
This is a Josh fight. At any rate, Barro had a pretty cranky little tweet storm about that precise public health official pointing out that she has.
She's a villain, if I may. She has been a villain. She's really one of the best. She's like our Ernest Blofeld, you know, in the Bond movies. Barbara Ferrer has been showing up in COVID videos from L.A. for, you know, the past 2.5 years.
Yeah, and the amount of power in her hands is breathtaking on limiting people's activities. They're going to, talking about
breathtaking, not unlike the COVID-19 respiratory virus.
Okay, can we cut? Were we cutting his mic? Did we have the kill switch yet?
There's no kill switch.
If we would have used it long ago.
It's all in your head, Matt. It's all in your head. I haven't said anything yet. Hi, Matt.
Catherine, I was reminded by somebody on the Twitter machine on Sunday that it was the 2-year anniversary then of then a New York City school chancellor, Richard Carranza, another pure villain in the public life.
His first name fits, just saying.
He it was the 2-year anniversary of him going on CNN with Jake Tapper, where Jake Tapper said essentially, like, hey, doesn't both the science and especially any kind of sense of equity or helping out poor students or looking around the world and seeing what lived-in experience has been, doesn't that suggest that we should reopen schools? And Richard Carranza, with the world's largest smirk, was like, oh, that's not science. That's science fiction, Jake. And it got me just stabby all over again, Catherine. It's not even science fiction. It got me stabby all over again about everything, especially the kind of smug appeals to science that were the opposite thereof. And seeing a lot of the recent news having to do with the FDA and about, for instance, the FDA is like, oh, yeah, the baby formula shortage. That was kind of us. But there's that. You have monkeypox, which Peter's going to tell us about here in a little bit. But I'm kind of in a burn it all down mode. By this, Catherine, after 2.5 years of this, when new stuff comes around and new problems arise and it's the same old problem, and the problem is the FDA, is it time to end it, not mend it? Damn it.
Absolutely. I mean, I have written Abolish the FDA as an editorial in Reason Magazine, looking back at it as I've had occasion to do a couple times in the last couple of years. Really stand by every single word of it. The FDA has done us no good and a lot of harm in the last couple of years. And, you know, I think people, a common response is like, well, okay, but the FDA quietly does a lot of useful things. And it's just that it's making headlines now with its world-shaking screw-ups. But, of course, many of the useful things it quietly does could and should be done in other ways. I will say, though, getting rid of the FDA will not solve our bad COVID health policy problems. It won't even come close because, as you have noted, many of our villains are friendly neighborhood villains. They are local public health officials who will continue on their merry way with or without FDA guidance, even perhaps more so. And I was just reading about monkeypox actually reading Donald McNeil's excellent piece for Barry Weiss. But
didn't have to use the N-word so much in that article, though. I get, but it was, you know, kicker, he was quoting a bunch of rap lyrics, but I don't know.
The kicker of the piece was actually wrong, though. He gets all the way through this very good analysis of the risks and some mitigation strategies that should already be in place, and that people aren't taking these strategies because they're scared of being perceived as anti-gay or making the same mistakes that we made at the beginning of the AIDS crisis. And then he says, basically, okay, so people who run sex parties should probably stop throwing those. And I think that's a good point. That's a real, like, hey, protect yourself, protect your community, be prudent. And then he skips right to, hey, this is just like in the 80s when San Francisco tried to shut down the bathhouses and the gay community resisted. And that jump, even in someone as really, like, you know, super well-versed in public health and public health policy as McNeil, that jump from people should make responsible decisions to the government should do it and people who resist the government for any reason should be condemned and blamed when things go wrong. Like, there's so much space between those two things. Has COVID not shown us there was so much space between these two things? Did AIDS not show us there was so much space between these two things? And the fact that we are just going to do it again, we are going to mess this up again, is quite astonishing to me. Obviously, banning sex parties for gay men is not going to make sex parties for gay men go away. And the weird pretense that that is the case, even by someone as plugged in as McNeil.
How in the world would you even enforce that?
But of course you can't. Are we going to go out with the paddy wagon?
I think you got to go undercover.
And round up the gays?
You got to get inside the system, Peter. You know, we need an inside man for
that. This is how you get Stonewall again. So, like, this is not the way.
We do have a great piece on FBI informants coming out.
It's always the fucking feds fucking.
It's terrifyingly easy, in fact, to imagine year 10 of monkeypox policy in which the FBI is using informants to shut down gay sex parties.
But the fact that we have two vaccines and a treatment for monkeypox really, we have no excuse if this thing gets out of hand. And yet I fear we will repeat our mistakes.
Peter, can you walk us through a little bit of what McNeil was saying? You know, as if one plague weren't enough, we now have another monkeypox and we're not handling it well. How are we not handling it well, according to Dr. Peter Suderman, the head of Justin Amash's CDC and FDA?
our own Doogie Howser here on the
Boy, pod. That's a lot of responsibility. Do I have to show up before 10 a.m.?
No, that's
okay.
Fine.
Okay, great. Yeah, so, Peter,
come on, it's a federal job.
I think that the FDA in particular is repeating a lot of the mistakes that were made at the beginning of COVID. In particular, they are slowing things down unnecessarily and insisting on a lot of box-checking paperwork just for the paperwork's sake itself. And so the best example of this is that, as Catherine said, we have a vaccine for monkeypox. We have two vaccines for monkeypox. But in New York, which is probably the epicenter in the United States of the monkeypox outbreak, those vaccines all disappeared very rapidly as people were starting to get afraid of this and as news was starting to come out. Now, fortunately, we have a bunch more vaccines. But they're in a facility in Europe, and that facility, it's in Denmark. That facility had not been inspected by the FDA. Now, the FDA had already inspected a separate facility from the same company, and the European Drug Agency had also inspected this this facility and said that it met both U.S. and European protocols. But even in the midst of what public health officials are saying is like a worrying potential big outbreak, this is spreading in new and novel ways, and like we really need to be on the ball about this, the FDA was like, well, no, we can't use those drugs yet. You know, we can't use those vaccines because we haven't inspected the facility. Even though there's absolutely no reason to think that this facility run by a company that the FDA has already approved another facility of and has also been inspected by our European counterparts. Absolutely no reason. Like, this has been given the government seal of approval several times over, and yet the FDA was like, no.
It's just like the baby formula.
We've got a process, and we've got to hold to the process. And similarly, when doctors are trying to treat people right now, there's been some very good reporting in the Washington Post about this. Doctors are going through like dozens or even, you know, hundreds of pages of paperwork every time they want to treat someone for monkeypox, and the bureaucratic burden, which doesn't make anyone any safer and doesn't make it makes it much harder to treat people, even if you say, well, you can do some of the paperwork later, right? So that's what the FDA has said. Well, maybe we can relieve this burden, not by actually canceling the paperwork burden, just by saying, well, you don't have to do it on the day that you treat the patient. But that still means they have to do it, and they still have to have the support staff. In addition, it's been very hard to get testing done and testing results. We saw this at the beginning of COVID as well, because public health authorities, the government health authorities, are trying to control this centrally, and so it's often days before people get their results back. The FDA is saying, well, you know, the CDC did botch the test kit with COVID the first time around. And so here we're going to try and not do that. But that means it's going to take time. And so at every point of the way, what the FDA and the CDC are doing with the response to monkeypox is they're slowing things down simply to slow things down in order to preserve their own bureaucratic power. And the argument they always make when they do this is, well, this is to preserve the credibility of the public health agencies. Like, really? You're destroying the credibility, if there is any left. And every single time they're like, no, if we don't follow the process, you know, that's, people aren't going to trust us. Do you think people trust you right now? Is there any reason for us to do so? I mean, it has been a catastrophe from day one of COVID. I mean, from the beginning of 2020, when we first, you know, started thinking about this in the United States. At every single point, the FDA and the CDC have chosen to slow things down for no good reason at all, except that they love paperwork and they think that that's what makes like their lives worth living.
Nick, just before you handed me the baton, the flaming baton of the editorship of mm-hmm. Reason Magazine, the print product, you published a
and
you
two, published from a cover story hands from to the this we throw it.
Jacob Sullum called an epidemic of meddling the totalitarian implications of public health. I thought at the moment that was a bit much. So totalitarian is a pretty strong word. I don't know.
That's like fine wine.
Maybe
like fine
I
wine,
was
Matt.
Wrong.
It's finally you, open. It's ready.
Do you want
for
to take
opening.
A victory lap, and or do you want to take the anarchist bait of saying like there's something corrupt at the root of public health, and until that corruption is fixed, get off us.
First, I want to mostly talk about the actual cover image, which. You know, and I did a lot of these during my, 8-year run as editor-in-chief. But that might be the very worst cover in recent history because it's stock art photo of a big finger pointing directly at the camera. And you can almost see like it's a whirl fingerprint pattern on it or something. It's just so bad. And I apologize.
We saved
for
a
that.
Lot of money back also, then on art. So let's.
Yeah. Yeah, like, you know, almost like $50 or $100, you know, by using that. And then there was the one that was I think it was the last cover, and I did this obviously as a gift to you, Matt, but it was supposed to be a, you remember the old Internet Explorer symbol of like something like a circle going around the globe, and we had like a turkey vulture.
I know.
Because it was about, you know, the Fed circling Internet Explorer or Microsoft for an antitrust case or something.
Like childbirth, I have scrubbed that from my memory.
It, yeah. So in any case, no, Jacob's piece is really strong, you know, and it's worth going back to. What's interesting is that Jacob, like myself, does not, you know, he's not an anarchist, and he believes I had a podcast conversation with him a while back with him and Ron Bailey and myself talking about what we had learned, because that was earlier this year when we thought COVID was actually over and things like that. There is a role for public health. Absolutely no question about it. If you are a libertarian, you know, from an anarchist perspective, any kind of public health agency, I think, is by definition, you know, a violation of, you know, universal human rights. I think this is the question that we need to be asking coming out of all of this is not, you know, whether or not public health agencies or authorities can work, but why are they not working, and how do you fix them? And I think, you know, partly with groups like the FDA and the CDC, and I think the FDA in particular, you know, it is really time to go past the kind of idea that one agency should have a monopoly on anything in the United States, especially when it comes to something like healthcare, whether it's medical devices or treatment protocols and things like that. You know, I think Liz Wolf at Reason recently wrote about IUDs on the website. And, you know, in passing, she comes back to a Reason chestnut, which is the idea that the FDA should not have a monopoly on what medical devices are allowable. You know, Europe does not do that. This is something that we had a cover story on back in the 90s. You know, why not open these things up for competition? Why not open up other kinds of procedures? That way you can say to people who think we need a government function, or sometimes a government function is good, like that'll still be there, but we have these other options.
Okay, we're going to get to the listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, worried about living in a media bubble? Having a hard time finding views that challenge your own? That's where The Lost Debate steps in. The Lost Debate is a podcast, you heard of those, and YouTube show for independent political thinkers who crave robust exchange of well-informed perspectives from a variety of viewpoints. The three co-hosts come from across the political spectrum. Former Obama administration staffer and school principal Ravi Gupta, progressive political organizer turned TikTok star Corey Bradford, and our dear pal Ricky Schlott, proud Gen Zer, New York Post contributor, and free speech champion. It's more conversation than Shoutfest. New episodes drop on Tuesdays and Thursday. Check out The Lost Debate today, wherever you find podcasts. You'll be glad you did. Okay, reminder to email your to-the-point queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Joseph Meisterski. Thanks for the pronunciation guide, though Slavs are the only place I punch above my weight. He writes after the usual nonsensical gushing praise. Brian Kaplan recently shared an old Salon article on Twitter titled "Libertarian Scary New Star, Meet Brian Kaplan, the Right's Next Great Philosopher." This was apparently worrying that he was going to become too influential. Being a Salon piece, it was pretty awful, but one part in particular stuck out to me. Quote, "For most of its post-1945 history, libertarianism has lacked thinkers of its own, and its intellectual deficit frequently has been filled by government-hating businessmen with third-rate minds, like Peter Thiel, the fatuous crackpot, good phrase, who founded PayPal, and the appallingly dumb Leonard Reed," end quote. As a libertarian who has done a fair amount of reading on the topics of liberty and capitalism, I was appalled at the ignorance, willful or not, of the writer. It got me wondering, who would the esteemed panel members cite as the most influential or their favorite post-war libertarian thinkers? Catherine, you go first. Tell me it's Brian Kaplan.
You know, I do love me some Brian Kaplan, as I've said many times on this podcast. I think he is great. I think Salon is right to fear him, and that it is only a good thing when Salon writes a hit piece on you. But I was actually going to raise Deidre McCloskey here, who is a frequent Reason columnist, the author most famously, I would say, of just some real doorstoppers in defense of the bourgeois virtues. She has a just a really cool kind of sweeping socio-economic political theory of things that is centers around this idea of the great enrichment, this moment that happens when humanity suddenly has more wealth, essentially, than it knows what to do with, and all the good stuff that falls from that. I think that it's like a really important reframing and a way of understanding intellectual history. She is readable, despite her habit of always referring to Adam Smith as the blessed Adam Smith. And she has been, you know, I think her reputation has been growing later in her life, and it will probably continue to grow after her death, and deservedly so. She is, of course, part of a long tradition of female libertarian thinkers, including the great Ayn Rand, the great Isabel Patterson, and the great Rose Wilder Lane. And she, you know, really continues that, like, come over here and listen to what I have to say. And also just like kind of a little bit casually, like, if you don't get what I have to say, then I don't like you and I don't care about you. I like the little punk rock element that libertarian ladies bring to the intellectual work. And Deidre is part of that tradition for sure.
Peter, who's yours and why is it a science fiction writer?
It's not a science fiction writer. The question is most influential libertarian thinker of the post-war era, and I honestly don't think it's a real competition. It's Milton Friedman. Milton Friedman, if we're just talking about sheer influence, it's Milton Friedman who helped end the draft, who was incredibly influential in both the Ronald Reagan administration and Margaret Thatcher's government in the UK, who informed a huge amount of our sort of contemporary thinking about monetary policy in particular. And he was just sort of amazing in his ability to do advanced academic technical work, as well as to be able to expound the virtues of freedom and of liberty to ordinary people and to connect those two things. I mean, this guy won a Nobel Prize for economics in the 1970s, right? He's incredibly respected by the sort of professional, you know, academic community, but he's also somebody who put together Free to Choose and was out there talking to ordinary people who don't read economics white papers and helping them to think through why freedom, why liberty is good for people and good for countries and good for society. And it's just, I just don't think that in terms of sheer influence, there's anybody who comes anywhere close who is a libertarian philosopher or academic since the end of World War II. And I think his influence was almost entirely good. I mean, it's just very hard to, you listen to him speak, and the clarity of his thought about why human freedom matters is remarkable, even 40 or 50 years later. Stuff that he was saying in the 60s and 70s and 80s is still just incredibly powerful to hear and to go back and to read some of his work. Also, it's often quite witty and funny.
Nick, you just got two taken off the table, so right. you're a droit.
Yeah, I know. I'm like, you know, I want to say Milton Friedman's greatest failure, though, was when he attempted to get our shared alma mater, Rutgers, to give up Division I sports. He teamed up with a literal bow tie wearing English
professor.
Man,
I like him better even more now.
Yeah, no, and it was like you take two
even
people who embody like but just like total nerds being like, you know, like, God, you know, the athletes are getting too much attention. It was a failed attempt, although in spirit they won, because Rutgers isn't really a Division I sports team. It is in the doormat division of the Big Ten, and now it will, which is being expanded so that they can be beaten on a regular basis by both USC and UCLA. Matt Welch, coming from Southern California, you'll enjoy that. But I think both of the people that have been mentioned, Deirdre McCloskey, is the best person pushing an ongoing, you know, reevaluation of what freedom means and what liberalism means as it's applied to economics and civilization. And Friedman, just the reach and impact of his work is great. I'm going to add two people to this list. One is a businessman who I actually talked with at Freedom Fest, who's not a third rate, you know, anything. John Mackey, the co-founder of Whole Foods, who is retiring in a couple weeks, and who has put into play the concept of conscious capitalism. You can take issue with the specific lingo he uses and whatnot, but his vision of post-industrial capitalism that is far broader and kind of more human-centered than virtually anything else that I've read. He debated famously Milton Friedman in the pages of Reason around 2005, Google, John Mackey, and Milton Friedman for that. But he's had a powerful influence, certainly less by his writing than by his stores. Whole Foods has, you know, changed not only the way that we think about grocery stores, but I think the way we think about a lot of policies ranging from free trade to labor practices to all sorts of things. And, you know, so he's somebody that I think people should think about and check out books like Conscious Capitalism. And then the other is that Salon article attacking Brian Kaplan was written by Michael Lind, who hates libertarians. I mean, it's the
only thing consistent throughout his ideological career.
Yeah, that and the idea of moving poor people from coastal cities to inner city, landlocked cities where they'll be more out of view of him and coastal elites, which he did in an Atlantic article years ago. And that is particularly disgusting and awful. But he sparred throughout the 90s with Virginia Postrell, the former editor-in-chief of Reason magazine. And I think when you look at her work in the 90s, and particularly its kind of culmination in The Future and Its Enemies, that's a book that synthesizes a vast amount of post-war libertarian thinking and points to a future that is still, I still find people, come up to me and say, you know, I just was reading The Future and Its Enemies. And, you know, it's a book that I think came out originally in 98. It's still a great way of thinking about liberalism and the application of different aspects of that, such as lifestyle, pluralism, and tolerance, and free market economics. So I'm going with John Mackey and Virginia Pastrell.
I will also say that Lind article, he says, oh, well, we can't count Nozick here because Nozick repudiated libertarianism late in his life. And that is also just garbage. If we see post-war or late 20th century philosophical debates as being basically like totally dominated by John Rawls, especially in the academy, Nozick is his only worthy opponent and was a worthy opponent.
I'll add not necessarily the most influential or necessarily favorite, but a category that I'm really fond of within libertarians. I don't even know if he self-describes as a libertarian, but he's certainly adjacent. Bjorn Lomborg, the environmentalist person, just his approach towards things, it just speaks to me in a thousand different ways, which is basically, okay, the climate is getting warmer. What is the best way that we can do something about it on a cost benefit basis? Let's try to figure out what are the most important, and we'll survey a bunch of academics and environmentalists and other people, and use this very practical kind of minded research and say, okay, what are the most significant and deadly environmental problems in the world, and what would they take to solve? And that work is just really phenomenal in like grounding what is usually much more a theological debate than it ever really gets given credit for when we talk about the environment and climate change and catastrophism and things like that. He says, no, let's make this concrete. How would we solve X? How do we solve the problem of people burning wood in their homes because that's their only source of fuel? How do we solve clean water issues in poorer countries? And he's done a remarkable bit of work. And the practicalness of that reminds me of the other person that I'll name here is Bob Poole, Robert W. Poole Jr. himself. That's what he's been doing for 50 years, 50 plus years, people. He's just doing great, great, great research on the subjects that animate him the most. Transportation being a chief among them, but not only, and doing it in such a way that has influenced policy, especially airline deregulation, but all kinds of transportation issues, doing it for decades and not pushing the rock up the hill on so many things that he's wanted to do. But his research is so top notch that the people who despise everything that libertarianism stands for respect him. And I totally appreciate that. He's a person who helped popularize the notion of privatization as a policy thing, right? Like Margaret Thatcher was waving around his work in the early 80s or late 70s, how to make City Hall work better. So Bob Poole, just that practical minded approach towards things is a way that so much of our political debate doesn't even get to. We would rather assess entire broad swaths of people as just untenable enemies because their hearts are not in the right place. And meanwhile, the people who do that almost never put in the actual work to try to get whatever they're doing done. Bob Poole's been doing that work forever. Shout out, Bob Poole. All right. Where are we now? We're at 11:46. I wanted to get in a lightning round, two lightning rounds, as a matter of fact. First, we'll start with Peter and Nick. Nick, you go first. What you saw at Freedom Fest, right? What you saw at the Southern Poverty Law Center's hate event, far-right hate event, so-called. They tried to shame Andrew Yang from appearing at a place with allegedly a bunch of far-right figures. I think it was a pretty shameful little hit piece on their point. But like, you guys did a reason a day. You're on the stage. You were juggling. What did you see there that was of interest to the people who couldn't go because they were busy at Rehoboth Beach?
Rehoboth Beach.
I'm never going to get there.
You know, I'll leave Peter to talk about the stage fronting, public stuff. At Reason, we were doing, not only did we have a bunch of great Reason Day panels about all sorts of things, including, you know, COVID lockdowns and drug policy and whatnot, but, you know, we bagged interviews with Glenn Greenwald, with Corey DeAngelis, with Zuby, and John Mackey, and John Cleese, the Monty Python guy who spoke from the main stage, and then I interviewed him for a bit, and that was certainly a highlight, talking about creativity. So, you know, he's obviously concerned about things like wokeism and political correctness, but primarily from the point of view of how do you have creative artists and other types of creative people working at their full capacity if they are internally checking every thought they have in order to make sure it doesn't offend a potential audience, you know, down the road. That was a big highlight for me. But we have a ton of content coming out of that. So I'm just going to give a quick preview of that. And then I'll listen to what Peter Suderman had. What did he see?
What did you learn at Freedom Fest? What did you see?
Well, I saw an interesting and eclectic group of people who were there to celebrate freedom. And it was great and heartening. And I love I love the sort of idiosyncrasies in our world, and like everybody's got the, like, their own approach to libertarianism, right? It's very sort of decentralized and dynamic, and there's all of these different, right? Like, there was in the Booth Hall where Reason had a booth, you could go to the Libertarian Christians group, or you could go to the Libertarian Atheists group, and like they were like right next to, not quite right next to each other, but like close by, and you see, like, and you know, then there's folks, like, there was like a VR table, right? And it's like, okay, so libertarianism is Christians and atheists and VR enthusiasts and Reason Magazine, and then every year there is, I never understand what it is and I never want to know, there is always a corner booth in which there's like a giant gold eagle.
Yes.
And I mean, it's like 4 feet tall, and it's surrounded by others, sort
You're
of like
giant gold eagle,
beautiful, like kind of crazy, elaborate, like, you know,
and there was
golden
that
animal
silver
things, right?
Full size Pieta, you know, of Mary holding Jesus taken down from the cross. I don't know if you missed that one, Peter.
All of those things.
It was almost too big to even take in.
At the Festival of Freedom, all of those things are represented because freedom encompasses all of them. Also, I think the single best thing that I have ever seen, or I should say the single best official thing that I have ever seen at a Freedom Fest happened at the dinner on the closing dinner on Saturday night, which is that Supreme, one of the members, affiliates, producers associated with the Wu-Tang Clan, showed up unannounced on stage and played a couple of old, rapped a couple of old Wu-Tang songs, and like the crowd, this like crowd of like somewhat older people dressed kind of in suits for like a hotel, you know, catered dinner situation, got on the dance floor and danced to Wu-Tang. And then Kennedy came out and was like, okay, guys, that happened. And then we went on with the show. It was just amazing.
Come on, Peter. If you're going to spill secrets about the gala, what was the other big performance?
It's already been mentioned here.
Shaolin, but you come out the other end when James O'Keefe sang selections from Oklahoma.
So that also happened.
At the same time.
And then I will add one more little tiny thing that we should just note. Since I mentioned Kennedy, we had an event with Friends of Reason on Friday night, and Kennedy showed up in a dress perfectly matching the AOC Tax the Rich dress, except hers said taxation is theft. And it was amazing. Just amazing to watch her like sort of swan through the Bellagio and like just sort of everybody like, wow, who is that wearing what? And then we walked back late at night just across the strip, and it was while she was wearing this thing and like hung out in the cocktail lounge in the middle of the Mirage. And it was just a completely delightful and perfectly fitting event. So many ways.
That's beautiful. Walking through Vegas with Kennedy under any circumstances is highly recommended. And not just that time when we, for a reason video, got as drunk as we could because we wanted to show the hangover cure the next day. Involved a lot of high-fiving. I'll leave it at that. A lot of high-fiving. Catherine, your lightning round is, obviously, tell us about how awesome the new Webb telescope is and what it all means.
It's pretty awesome. I will put a caveat on here, which is that much as I have no appreciation for the beauties of terrestrial nature, I am a space girl, but not a space telescope girl. I know. It's a ridiculous distinction, but here it is. Your girl who can't appreciate or experience awe. I will say, though, you know, obviously I have been following the telescope. The pictures that came back are pretty cool. I, like many people, wondered and always wonder when I see these pictures, like, what are the colors? Are the colors real? The colors represent real things, but are not colors you would see if you were out there at the edge of space, just to be clear. A lot of it is infrared light,
and therefore
not visible
from suffocation
to the naked eye. The colors are information, but the colors are not color, just in case you were wondering. I will say this telescope.
That's like color in the real world. Colors are always just information. Our eyes and brains.
I will send you into the outer reaches of space. I swear to God. This telescope was hella expensive in a stupid way because government money isn't real money. NASA money, doubly so. And after NASA screwed up in 1990 and sent Hubble into orbit with a mirror that was the wrong shape, they were very embarrassed about that, and so they did a lot of things to make sure they didn't make that specific mistake again, to the tune of like $8 billion. And, you know, I think that we have seen in the private sector with the rockets that I do enjoy how if the money is real and someone's real money that could be used for other things in the world, all of this just gets done very differently. So, yes, the Webb telescope is cool. Yes, telescopes in general are cool and important scientific instruments. No, my heart was not filled with joy at looking at those pictures. I like rockets
you
only.
You are a robot. All right, let's go to our end of show. What we have...
Beep, boop, motherfucker.
What we have been consuming. Wow. Nick, why don't you lead us off?
I've been reading The Kingdoms of Savannah, the new novel by George Oz Green, who had previously written The Juror, The Caveman's Valentine, and Ravens, all three extremely highly regarded. Two of them made into movies, which weren't so good. But George Dawes Green is also the founder of The Moth, the event program and podcasts and public radio fixture where people tell stories based on real life experiences. And George Dawes Green, the Kingdoms of Savannah is set in that city in Georgia, and it's a fantastic, historically rich, gripping thriller, a police procedural kind of thing. He's also the guest at the next Reason Speakeasy in New York City, which takes place on Wednesday, July 27th. Tickets are $10. It's going to be a great evening of storytelling and the persistence of history, whether we're talking about Georgia or New York City or America more broadly. We're going to be talking about The Moth and the need for personal storytelling in an age when everybody has a microphone, what makes good storytelling versus bad storytelling, all of that. But that's the next Reason Speakeasy. Go to reason.com/events and get details and buy tickets ahead of time.
Awesome. Peter?
I have been watching The Old Man on Hulu. It's also been airing on FX. It's a sort of a spy thriller starring Jeff Bridges and John Lithgow as like old frenemy rivals who are in the intelligence world somewhat murkily, right? So as it turns out, as the story develops, you find out that basically Jeff Bridges' character, who goes under a bunch of different names, was running some operations in Afghanistan decades ago, and that John Lithgow's character, who is now who in the sort of present day timeline, is a sort of senior guy at the FBI, was the handler for Jeff Bridges, but Jeff Bridges' character was doing stuff that was not entirely authorized. And now, decades later, it is coming back to bite both of them. It's a little pretentious, I'm going to be honest, and I think it won't be for everyone. The plotting in particular gets a little bit absurd, but it's so well shot and so well acted, and the script, the dialogue really commits to giving the two lead actors, but also the supporting cast, which includes Aaliyah Shawkat as someone who has a relationship with both of the older leads, is all I'll say. It commits to giving them these really long kind of winding monologues in which they can speak to each other at length and sort of in like these big chunky meaty paragraphs of words. And it's just so pleasant to hear these guys speak like that, like they should be able to chew through these monologues. Not every one of them works, but enough of them do that I just am like, oh yeah, there's Jeff Bridges. There's the dude. And he's at this point, he's got this voice. And it's just like he's like he's sort of weird thunder god from the bottom of a volcano. You know, he's just, it's so deep and there's just this graveliness to it. And he speaks real slow. And it's like, I just want to listen to the timbre of his voice as he says literally anything. And that this is a great show to kind of scratch that itch.
Catherine.
First of all, I want everyone to go back and re-listen to Suderman on Monologues as a meta commentary on Suderman's monologues. Just like sit with that. I was on vacation, so I read and consumed a lot of things, including the Thor movie. And also because I found it in a little free library, Starship Troopers, wow, which I had actually never read, despite having read basically all other Heinlein, because someone told me at some point, like, that's the fascist one. And so I just didn't read it, but I read it on the beach. But the book I want to talk about is actually a very weird little, it's maybe 150 pages, skinny little book recommended to me by my COVID book club. It is called Last Night at the Lobster by Stuart Onan, and it is just a story about the last day that a branch of Red Lobster is open in Connecticut. It's just that. It's just like the manager of this Red Lobster experiencing his experience of the last day before his store is closed. I know that that does not sound like it's going to be a good book.
Did something go wrong with the bisque?
A bunch of things go wrong, but none of them are very important. It's just good. It's just like a weird, good little book about people doing people stuff. And
does it take place during Crab Fest?
It's all you can eat shrimp night. Thank you for asking. Okay. But
are they fried or is it
scampi? Asking her questions.
It's a good book. It's a
book.
Weirdly,
a choice of boiled or fried.
Go ahead, Catherine.
A weirdly beautiful little
book.
It
is a novel, though.
It is a novel. Right? But it's a novella. Like, it's so short. It's so fast. Yeah.
So, why is the Red Lobster closing? Because every franchise, I mean, they always seem to be packed.
The receipts were not high enough at this location, and our hero is being transferred to become an assistant manager at a nearby Olive Garden, and he has a lot of thoughts and feelings about that, too.
What year is it set in?
That sounds great.
Now-ish.
Because one of the most memorable field trips I ever took as a child.
I swear to God, if you tell me a long Red Lobster story right now or a story about the alligator restaurant,
I'm
will
get my phone to
storm
ring.
Out of this booth.
Was to Olive Garden. And the fact that you stood out to me that blew my like 9-year-old mind.
Why is this happening to me?
Was that Olive Garden was opening a new restaurant in America every Monday. Every single Monday there was a brand new Olive Garden. That is so many breadsticks. Capitalism is great, folks.
And they were all free.
The breadsticks and free salad were great. Catherine, have you eaten at Red Lobster? Do you like Red Lobster?
I'm not sure I've ever been to a Red Lobster.
Yeah. I love those kinds of chain restaurants at least once, and I know that at various points they helped me get into different types of cuisine, weirdly. So I have a real soft spot for that kind of stuff, even when people always rank on them, but
we'll bring the interrogating Catherine's the weekly interrogating Catherine's editorial choices, consumption choices section of the podcast to a close, and I will finish with mine. A couple weeks back, I threw up on late night Twitter, meaning vomited, the song "The Things We Do for Love" by 10cc, the December 1976 top 10 hit. And I invited people to list a favorite song of theirs that reminded them of in any way, shape, or form. And with the idea of making a playlist, because I'm a Gen Xer, and people vomited forth all kinds of their own wonderful, strange things. It took me a while, but I cobbled that into a playlist. If you like to go on Spotify and find me, it's there. But a song there that has blown my mind, blown my camouflage shorts clean off, Catherine, is from a band that I'd never heard of and a song I'd never heard of called The Darkness is the band. They're a early 2000s unabashed glam metal British band. Do just the terrible teeth and the shirt off, and right before the guitar solo goes guitar, like the whole thing. But it's not just how great the song "I Believe in a Thing Called Love" is; it's the video. It's just there are aliens that are coming. The guitar is fighting off the space worms. Everything that you want in a stupid rock video and song is there. It has filled me with enough happiness to last me at least another week on this planet. So The Darkness, I Believe in a Thing Called Love, but especially the video. Go check it out. Speaking of checking it out, check out all of our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts, including the newish at this point, Reason Rundown. With Peter Suderman. Peter, can you give us a rundown of what we have in store coming up in the nearish future on the Rundown Reason podcast?
Yeah, so it's the Reason Rundown. It's the podcast to end your week. It is one Reason journalist, one big topic every week, comes out on Fridays. We have 3 episodes in the can already. You can get a sample of what this is like. Last week, I spoke to Jacob Sullum about Japanese gun policy and what we can learn from that in the United States. Just a fascinating conversation and the kind of thing that I'm hoping to do every week. That's the plan is we have so many super smart, super interesting people on staff who know so much about so many different topics. And I want to bring that to Reason listeners in podcast form. We've got another episode coming up this Friday. It was great to be at Freedom Fest and hear, talk to people who had already subscribed and were already listening. I hope that listeners of the Reason Rundown will follow suit and will find time in their week to listen as well.
Sweet. Thank you. And if you like our stuff, generally speaking, whether it's Bob Poole, whether it's podcasts, whether it's 15-year-old cover clip art, whatever it is that you love about Reason, go to reason.com/donate and make your tax deductible. Donation. Tax-free. Whatever. Check it out. Anyways, thanks, and we'll see you next week. Bye.